And you have just tuned in to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Tonight, our host is KHSU General Manager Peter Fretwell.
Thank you, Michael. When Lorna Bryant informed me she was taking a few days of vacation time to attend the Democratic State Convention in San Diego, I said, okay. I thought. So, wait a minute. You're going to some of the nicest weather in California, to a city with an incredible food scene, several world-class microbreweries, a world-famous zoo, and did I mention the incredible restaurants? And you're going to go sit in a convention center for 3 days and listen to politicians? Glad it's your vacation and not mine. That's what I thought to myself. I didn't say it out loud, did I?
No.
Okay. Then, as time passed, Lorna went and came home. And she convinced me, or nearly so, that it was worth the 14-hour drive through snow, sleet, and rain, sleeping in a bone-chillingly cold Airbnb, to see the California Democratic Party convention. So tonight, on Thursday Night Talk, Lorna Bryant is going to convince you of the same thing, and she is joined by two veterans of the convention battles who will help her convince you that you need to book your next vacation to be at a state political convention. And yes, before you call and ask, we will offer the same KHSU broadcast time to Republicans from here who attend the state convention in May in, where else?
San Diego.
There you go. Okay. So, we're going to start this evening by going around the table and ask each person at the table to tell us four things. What is your name? What is your day job? How many state conventions have you attended? And where do you see yourself fitting into the current California Democratic spectrum politically? Where do you sit on the bell curve in the Democratic Party in California? So to start with the young lady to my left, what is your name, young lady, and where do you work?
My name is Lorna Bryant. I am currently employed by KHSU, where my general manager is the illustrious Peter Fretwell to my right.
This was your first state convention?
This was my very first convention. I was asked to be a proxy delegate for Mitra Abidi, who was an elected delegate, I believe so. And
where do you sit on the political spectrum? Compared to what you saw, there are 3,300 delegates there. Where would you say you fit into that political spectrum? I'm asking this question bluntly because every listener out there is going to try and decipher it anyway. So let's just put it to bed and tell them where you see yourself.
Let's see. I think I was out in the parking lot of the convention center floor. I think that's where I saw myself. Probably right in the middle.
Right in the middle of the bell curve. Okay.
Yes. Right. I think that's, yes.
All right, let's move on. You, young lady?
My name is Lynn Rivier. I am an elected ADEM. I work for Internews Network, which is a nonprofit in Arcata, started in Arcata, that supports independent media globally.
Okay.
This is my third convention. My very first California state convention was actually in 1968. And then I was at the convention in 2017 and 2018. And political spectrum-wise, I would consider myself a pretty solid progressive to the left.
Okay.
Delegate.
Okay. And you, sir?
My name is Robert Shear. I'm an executive board member for our assembly district. And I would say, this is my third convention. I did 2016, 17, and 18. The first one I attended as a delegate for Senator Sanders, and the second two as an elected delegate. And I would say I'm pretty far to that left of that bell curve, and my role as a delegate I see as trying to pull those that are stuck on the right at least back towards the center. To represent the interests of people rather than the unfortunate way our party is being pulled, in my opinion.
All right, so one thing you did in 2016 in Philadelphia is you held up a sign. What did that sign show?
What we were speaking about earlier. Well, it was mentioned, would I ever imagine that we would be where we are today? And I clarified, well, you mean with Trump and all? And I said, yeah, I did. I did actually foresee this. You know, in 2016, a lot of my fellow Sanders delegates in Philadelphia came together and told the superdelegates as best as we could with a press conference and a big petition that this is what we foresaw and we predicted, because we were out there registering voters every day and people didn't want to have it. They were done with the establishment. And we held up a sign. It was a map predicted by Nate Silver, the statistician, of the way that the votes would turn out in each of the states. And it was actually exactly the way it turned out.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we'll come back to that a little bit later as we talk about San Diego and the current California Democratic Convention. First question for you folks. The convention theme this year was the Big Blue Beacon of Hope. And I looked at that. What does that mean? Okay, blue state, and California is traditionally a leader in politics. Is that presumptuous based on what you actually saw in San Diego, or did you come away saying it's true?
I can't answer that question because I have nothing to compare it to, but I will say, as an African-American woman, I felt frequently as though we were the great beacon of hope. Many people referred back to Alabama and how African-American vote, particularly the African-American woman vote, made a change. So I almost felt as if I was being looked at as the great beacon of hope as an African-American woman.
And you have some stories on that we'll get to later.
Absolutely.
I would say that one of the takeaways I had for this convention that was positive and may relate to this was I saw a lot more, at least, discussion of the progressive agenda that we've been pushing. And I think that there is some movement to actually welcome the progressive wing of the party. And I think that's definitely a good thing in the long run. I think that positions us in a place where we can take back some of the red and purple counties in our state. So I may have had objections to the imagery, but I do think there is, hope for picking up a lot more seats in Congress.
Specifically, California has 53 House of Representatives seats. 39 of those are currently Democratic, 14 are Republican. You're saying California could send more Democrats
to the
U.S. House.
Right, more Democrats. I think we're looking at maybe seven to nine.
Out of the 14, wow.
That can be flipped.
Okay. Robert?
Is California a big blue beacon of hope? I'd have to say it really depends on the context. You know, in some districts and in some races across the country, California could be seen as a beacon of hope. But again, that's really only on certain policy issues where our candidates might be better. Do I really think that California Democratic Party is a beacon? I don't really think so. I think that our party has actually been hijacked by corporate interests. The truth is actually at the convention, broadcast onto the wall and on folded things on the tables were the lists of our corporate sponsors. Those included just a brief list, if I may.
Sure.
Against Rent Control is the California Apartment Association, was a tier one sponsor. Against Net Neutrality's Comcast. Against Single Payer, the list goes on. And that was one of our biggest issues in 2017. And that includes Blue Cross, Anthem, the California Hospitals Association, the California Dentals Association, the Private Insurance Federation of California, and Optometrist Association, and a few others. As long as those are the people that are sponsoring the place where we put together our platform, which openly pushes policy that stands in stark contrast to theirs, it's not going to work.
Okay. So let's reframe the question slightly, but come out a little different way. If California does lead the nation in trends politically and social, what did your time in San Diego tell you about what lies ahead of the United States for the next 3 to 7 years? Robert?
Sure. I guess you mean like with the presidency and all.
Is absolutely, yeah.
I think then to echo Alain's sentiments, we've definitely changed the narrative. At the convention, we heard all of these governor candidates speak. Four governor candidates of the five. One was not allowed to speak, actually, and all of them mentioned single payer. Even those that were, very sponsored by some of those who also sponsored this event. So we are changing the narrative, and in that sense, we're kind of winning, you know, in a large part thanks to Bernie Sanders, who actually, like we were discussing before, might run again. And that's a beacon of hope for me, quite frankly. I think what lies ahead for the next 3 to 7 years, I'll kind of say what Bernie would say. That depends on the way that millions of people across this country respond to what's happening right now, whether it's with complacency or taking the call to action, getting involved with the party, coming to the convention, sitting in the Rules Committee meeting like Alen is on, and forcing change to happen.
Let's talk about single payer for just a second as one of those bellwethers of where the country might head if California goes down that road. Did you come away feeling like California might seriously look at single payer in the next few years?
It's been a struggle because there is solid support for single payer, and pretty much every single candidate has to support single payer or SB 562 to get the support of many of the delegates. Whether there's a political will in the California legislature is a real question, because what we've seen is it's been shelved. It hasn't been allowed to come out of the Rules Committee in the Assembly to actually further the legislation itself to make it a reality. So there's a lot of window dressing, there's a lot of support for it, but in reality, you know, and there's huge support for it within the state, but I don't see our assembly members pushing, having the political will to really push it, including our assembly member Wood.
Okay.
For me, and once again, I look at everything through the lens of an African-American citizen of this country, this state, and as an African-American woman. I won't make that prevalent in every comment that I make, but it is important to me. I don't know where this country will be in 5 to 7, in this state will be in 5 to 7 years. Politically, if we don't learn to work with each other personally, politics mean absolutely nothing if we don't learn to treat each other with respect.
Okay.
And that's that. I think the two will affect each other. And unless we learn to work with each other well, just on a personal level, politically, I don't know where our state will be.
Okay, so let's go on then. What did you see in San Diego on that front? A number of national news media heading in and afterwards portrayed California Democrats as a party at war with itself. Did your time in San Diego give credence to that view, or did you come away saying, no, I think we're making progress. This is democracy in action. It's messy, but it's working. How did you come away?
Well, Alen and Bobby, I was told that, again, this was my first time, but I was told that it was the most diverse presence at a convention that has ever been seen. Did you see that?
Well, I think the fact that we had a huge wave of left progressive Bernie-crats win the ADEM elections really changed the composition, and I think that was evident, you know, at the convention this time. That's been for two conventions now, and I think we are making waves to some extent and pushing the narrative to the left or to include the diverse voices. That is democracy, little d democracy, that really needs to happen.
But messy.
It's messy.
Okay. Robert?
I love this question. You know, I think it's not, you didn't pose it as an either or, but I think that it's kind of both. You know, we are at war with ourselves in this party, but that is democracy in action.
It is.
You know, there is definitely a rift in our party. And I think that's in California, our party is like a big shining example of what it means to of what it is. We represent both the internal tensions that are seen throughout the Democratic Party in across the nation, mm-hmm. as well as really just the struggles of everyday people. I mean, and that's felt and reverberates throughout the nation too. Yeah. And the progressive wing of our party, our state party, really echoes that loudly. We're boisterous about it, you know? And that was evident here at the convention. I mean, there's protests throughout it, you know? So if you want to oversimplify a situation, there's kind of two big groups on that bell curve that you mentioned mm-hmm. before. You know, there are the reformers who want to see the little d democratic values and, you know, fully injected into our big D Democratic Party. And then there's the true blue no matter who's that, you know, say that we got to go with the Democrat regardless who it is. A Democrat's better than a Republican. Who cares? And to that I say, you know, we've got some Republicans both here in our county supervisors as well as in our assembly, our state Senate, and in the White House, or, you know, in Congress, who are Democrats that they say, but really they're Republicans. We call them dinos, Democrats in name only.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what I'm here to change. I consider myself, like I said, on that further left end of it as a reformer, you know. And inherently, if we're working within this big blue corporate machine, as you put it, we're going to be at war with ourselves because we're pushing an agenda that's completely the opposite. We're talking about taking this money out of politics.
So for you, that would be the benchmark of having succeeded in this, is to see politics driven by people, not by money.
I think that we would be in a very different situation today if we went into the 2016 elections with publicly funded campaign cycles and open elections where everybody was allowed to vote. And if Election Day was a national holiday, if you had to vote, even if it was a law and you get a $50 fine if you don't or something, you know, I think, yeah, that would change. That would have changed everything if elections were treated the way that they are important, that, you know, they're as a staple of our democracy, that we would not have Trump. We'd have Bernie Sanders.
Okay. So let's go to the real nubbin of the whole hour, this question. Name your top three takeaways from the convention, issues or political personalities you came away saying, stay clear of that person or embrace that person.
I was very pleased to see Delaine Easton get 20% of the vote.
Yeah.
I have to admit. Uh-huh. I mean, I've been a strong supporter of her, and she's been way down in the general polls, but having her get 20% was huge in the convention.
Tell our listeners who she is.
Pardon? She is a former superintendent of public instruction. Okay. She has many, many, many years of experience as an elected. She is not taking any corporate money. She's strongly supporting single payer, anti-fracking, free public tuition. She actually went to UC Davis at the same time I did, and we had free public tuition during that time. It was the only way I could afford to go to college.
Okay.
So, you know, she doesn't take corporate money. It was very interesting. I was being pushed by one of the other supporters of another candidate to support them, and I kept saying, well, she's you know, anti-fracking. Well, this person does too. And I'm like, and she supports free public tuition. This person does too. And I'm like, and she doesn't take any corporate donations. Oh, and they just turned around and walked off.
Okay.
So that was
that's one personality.
Okay.
What about issues, other people? Any personality who just absolutely turned you off and said, okay, I went in thinking I might vote for her or him, but no.
Oh, I can't think of... Bobby, do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, there was the...
Bobby does.
Not that surprised me, but I keep thinking of Dianne Feinstein.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I mean, Dianne, you want to... Dianne Feinstein was on stage, you know, and she
got up and she spoke, and actually Kevin DeLeon made a pretty good speech, an impassioned speech as well, but Dianne Feinstein got up, she started speaking, she kept speaking. It wasn't very compelling, but then her time was up and the music starts and starts and starts, and finally she said, well, I guess that means my time's up.
And the crowd.
Everyone in the convention, yes. Or a lot of people in the convention, right, said, yes, your time is up.
Literally and figuratively.
Let's talk about that one for a minute. Seniority matters in the United States Senate. It matters a great deal. And if voters in California turned away from her, we would lose a tremendous amount of clout in the United States Senate. Is it worth it at this point in our political history?
Yes.
Right. Absolutely.
Why?
Because principle over politics, and that's actually the credence of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And that has to be the way that they actually do it.
Okay.
Otherwise, we're not really, you know, it's the little d. We've got to put the little d before the big D.
Interesting.
Okay. In our actions and our policy.
Mm-hmm. Takeaways?
I think the coolest part of it for me was being able to take our local candidate here for the 2nd Assembly District race against Jim Wood, our professor here, HSU professor Kevin Murray. He's a political science professor here, and introducing him to all of our delegates down there, and to just see such incredible reception to a progressive candidate for the assembly from our district here, who actually favors single payer and has for decades, mm-hmm. and who favors rent control, when Jim Wood, who sits on the housing committee, decided not to vote. You know, he decided to abstain from a vote to repeal the Costa-Hawkins Act. That would have overturned an act that made it so that we can't have rent control, basically, in California. So that was probably the most exciting to me, to see that great widespread statewide reaction to our local candidate for the first time.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was really mm-hmm. cool.
Also, we had the Progressive Caucus had a panel discussion, including Tulsi Gabbard, that was, yes. I think, very interesting, just talking about war and regime change and the new direction the party needs to go.
To go, okay.
There are a lot of caucuses, by the way, in the mm-hmm. At the convention.
So I'm seeing an interesting thing here. You two veterans of the conventions are settling for incremental mine canary changes, things that you say that's a sense that we're moving in the right direction. You're not talking about big sweeping personalities or something like that. You're measuring your steps and saying this is going to take a while.
This is going to take a while.
Yeah, I mean, okay. We recognize that. And being on the rules committee, I realize that, you know, changing these rules is not going to be quick or easy.
Easy, yeah. When Robert mentioned that, I thought I'd rather have a root canal without Novocaine than to sit on a rules committee.
Oh, those meetings are like 8 hours
yeah,
long. Too
yeah.
treacherous.
Treacherous, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Wow. Yeah.
That was one of the first things I did. When I arrived to the convention, I went to the Rules Committee hearing, and wow, that was, I mean...
You almost got out of politics before you got in.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so for you, takeaways or personalities or whatever?
Let's see, where do I begin? Takeaways. So, again, because I am a newbie, I was viewing the entire process through a totally different lens. The first thing that I noticed, I'm sure not many other people did, the waste of all of the paper everywhere.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've been indoctrinated into recycling and doing yoga or something here in Humboldt County. I'm not sure, but it was a hazard. One year, you're on a shiny concrete floor, and there were banners and signs and leaflets and pamphlets and stickers and everywhere. And I was afraid to walk, because the moment you walked on it, it became a
slip and slide.
Yeah. So that was one. That was one observation that I made. The second was, politics is dirty. And politics in some forms is grimy. And in other forms, just outright gross. When the elections took place, I felt like I was in the Super Bowl, and I was on one team, and there were fans lining the walls as I was going through a tunnel, rooting me on. But those fans were actually candidates asking for my vote. As I was walking through the corridor heading in to vote, the most stark contrasted comment that was made, it blew me away. I was walking in, and I was actually walking in at the same time with the mayor of Arcata, mm-hmm. Sophia Pereira. We walked in together, and Kevin De Leon, who is... the Dianne Feinstein's competition, or actually, Dianne Feinstein is, you get the picture. Mm-hmm. But he looked at Sophia Pereira and said, "Hi, I'm Kevin." In the same breath, he looked at me and he said, "Black Lives Matter. You know that, right, sister?" It was like I had an epiphany at that moment, and I didn't know that. And I didn't know that I was a sister, and I didn't know Black Lives Matter, but it was when Kevin De Leon told me that, I realized that. And it was actually a little offensive that in the same breath, he said, "I'm Kevin" to Sophia Pereira, and then he told me that Black Lives Matter, as if I didn't know already.
Did it change your vote?
Oh, well, I wasn't planning on voting for him at that moment, but when he said that, all bets were off for me. If you are a sincere person, your message is the same for every person. It's not, "Hi, I'm Kevin" for one person and "Black Lives Matter" for another. That, it was disgusting to me.
Okay.
It was absolutely disgusting. And there was one other question.
Just takeaways as far as issues?
The last thing, I attended a few of the caucus meetings. I went to the African American caucus, and I finally had to tap out at about 10:30 because it was going on. It began at 7:30, and at 7:54, according to the draft agenda, political directors' reports and candidates wanted to speak. And every person that we saw during general session was in this tiny small room to try to get the votes of the African American caucus. That was amazing to me. So Gavin Newsom was there, Antonio Villaraigosa was there, John Chiang was there. Everybody who was everybody wanted to speak. And guess what? They did.
They did.
And guess what? When 10:30 rolled around and we turned to the second page and we see a list of 30 more candidates for various positions, they were still there and still wanting to vote. I'm wanting to speak. By that time, their 3 minutes got reduced to 30 seconds to say your name, what office you're running for, and that was it. The power of the African American vote was realized in Alabama, and it reinforced at the African American convention, I think. I got the most out of going to the African American caucus than anything else during the convention.
Did you get the sense this will be a new dynamic in 2018?
I think what she's speaking to in both of those comments is identity politics, and that's been something that's been a thing since politics
Sure.
has been a thing. I think right now it's we're making new and forceful pushes in our use of it across the spectrum. I think that's actually rather unfortunate, you know, as much, like, I'm a big Delaine Easton fan, like Alain was talking about before, and as much as, I walked around the convention and I said to some of those Newsom supporters that were just getting obnoxious at certain points that a woman's place is in the governor's mansion, and, you know, I felt a little bad after I said it, even that, you know, because still, it's not because she's a woman that she belongs there, it's because she's got the best policy, you know, and I don't like to see that loyalty to, even to, like, your union brothers and sisters. It's like, at what point does it, you know, does that loyalty to somebody for some sort of favor or some sort of relationship just triumph over your actual connections to the your motivations, your values that are motivating you to be involved with politics in the first place? And I think there's an unfortunate disconnect from those values with a lot of people where they let identity politics drive things instead.
Can identity politics and little d democracy or democratic principles cohabitate peacefully? Can they work
like together? I think it depends on how we're using it. And okay. she said also that it's dirty. I mean, you know, Lerna was, you know, you say, you know, it's very dirty, and that's the way that it's going to be used. And so, I mean, of course, it's great for an African American woman to relate to her sister, or for, you know, whoever X to, you know, mm-hmm. to their other Y
sure.
or whatever. But to make that the basis of a campaign is wrong.
Okay. You know, it's funny you say sister. I was called sister so many times over those 2.5 days that I called my brother up and I said, you know, you don't call me sister as much as I get called sister.
I call my sister sister all the time.
I call my brother's brother and my niece's niece. But that wasn't, it was sister E-R, not sister, but it was implied sister. And again, you know, I felt as though I was being pandered to. Mm-hmm. The entire time, I was standing in line at the only edible, the only place I could eat a decent meal. I mean, there were convention cafes, but there was a Starbucks inside, so I had to have my caffeine every morning, and there was an elderly woman behind me who was very argumentative, and there was always someone petitioning something the entire time, throwing a petition in front of you, a sign in front of you, to the point where my comment was, no, thank you, and that's how I got out of it all. I learned quickly. But this woman didn't want to hear what this petitioner had to say, but kept encouraging him to tell her more. And then she deflected and said, but it's a woman like her. And she pointed at me and tapped me on the shoulder. A woman with this tan is going to make a difference. And I looked at her and kindly moved away and said, I don't have a tan. And stop referring to my skin tone as a tan. But it's your tan. You need to get your family out to vote. And I said nicely where I live. I said to her, where I live, there are only three of us here. So it would be difficult. And she said, well, get your cousins to... Okay.
But enough of that conversation. Yeah, painful conversation. All right, speaking of painful things,
yes.
Before we went on the air... The food wasn't the only problem. The accommodations overnight for all three of you proved to be a little bit perplexing at certain moments. You had an Airbnb that was like an icebox.
50 degrees inside.
And the Airbnb operator would not turn up the heat, or?
I was afraid to ask.
Okay. You were in a beautiful Victorian mansion.
Where he had the heat on all the time.
But it was a nice place.
It was beautiful. It was a stunning 1912, huge three-story mansion.
But it was so hot you couldn't sleep.
It was, I sleep cold. I'm in Humboldt County. I'm used to cold.
And Robert?
No Airbnb and no temperature issues, but they called up to my room about 5 hours after I checked in, and about 12:30 in the morning, woke me up and said to come downstairs with my receipt that they had some error checking me in. I had to tell them that I would see them in the morning, have coffee, you know, after that, waited in that line, hopefully with no petitions. Busy day the next day.
So I did have one little consolation. After 2 days in this very lived-in, nicely cluttered, very cluttered home. I got an offer to take over the room of someone who was leaving early at the Hilton. I never packed my bags
so fast. All right.
But I did.
Right above the convention.
Yes. Nice. It was nice. And I could see Coronado from my room. Almost like seeing Russia from my house, right?
Yeah. There's a political reference to go back twice. Okay, so let's move on to issues then. What major issues, in your opinion, did the convention fail to address that you were hoping they would address? You've talked about some of the incremental improvements and hopeful things you saw. What are some of the things that you went in thinking?
I would think just on a logistical basis, we came out of the last convention noting that there was a real problem with accessibility for disabled peoples, and we brought that up in the Disabilities Caucus, and I believe they moved it forward to higher levels in the party. And it was unfortunate to see that there was no line, that people had to wait on these incredibly long lines, that there was nobody trying to keep the floor clean from those hazards in the general session. Just to make things easier for them, you know, there's several hundred of those 3,300 delegates.
Absolutely.
Are, you know, among those that might find it challenging to make their way or to wait in a long line where people are yelling at them from all angles. and some people in wheelchairs. So that was an unfortunate logistical thing, comes to mind.
For me, I saw more lack of organization and efficiency than I would have expected. Right. You know, one of the caucuses I went to, it took an hour just to get into the room, and everything was held up. The caucus members really didn't have a chance to even get through the agenda. It was just very, very unorganized and inefficient. And to me, those problems shouldn't be coming to the forefront. We've had how many conventions?
Right.
There should be standard procedures that work.
Okay.
That was my biggest frustration as well. I think we were standing in the same line for a ridiculous amount of time. There were three lines, but they were doing the same thing but saying differently. So it was very confusing. I thought fights were going to break out around me. Oh, I'm not exaggerating.
No.
I thought fights were going to break out. And this, can I say which meeting this was?
The Rural Caucus.
This was the Rural Caucus. So not the city folk. It was the country folk who were quite impassioned.
And not used to lines.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, it's just true.
One thing, as a Humboldt County resident, former Los Angeles County resident, it was very exciting to ride escalators. Because I don't think there is a single escalator in all of Humboldt County. Yeah. So it was fun to ride. I felt like it was a stairwell, a moving stairwell to heaven. It was probably four stories.
Yeah. The protests on the escalators are always fun, too. They tell you got to keep moving. You can't stay in any one place. So whenever a protest of some sort would break out, you know, they say you got to just go up and down the escalator.
So that's where they did the
just chanting with their signs.
That was one place.
It was the rent is too damn high.
Yeah, the rent is too damn high. Anybody who's listening, really, you should look up repeal Costa Hawkins.
Yes.
If we can make that happen, if we can push through a repeal of Costa Hawkins, it would allow for rent stabilization across California. And that's unfortunate. As I told you, our convention was sponsored by a California Apartments Association who day in and day out employs lawyers who fight against this. So we really need the people who are listening who are renters to just look into this. Call Jim Wood. He's our assembly rep here in Humboldt, and he screwed us last month when he didn't vote. I mean, we need everybody to call him and say, hey, I'm a renter. I'm drowning in student debt. Why did you not vote for rent control in California? You know? Again, we've got Kevin Murray running against this guy, Jim Wood. Check him out. Facebook.com/KevinFORCA. Kevin for California.
You know, that is very important in our community where we face so much homelessness, especially student homelessness, where we have homes that are either not available or unobtainable because of the rent prices. And to have this conversation, you know, I remember Prop 13 back in the 80s when I lived in Los Angeles. I was a teenager, and that was groundbreaking at that time. But we're still having this conversation, you know, almost 40 years later about affordable housing. It doesn't make sense.
Do issues like that get time at a convention like this? Do they get moved
forward?
We
just started a renters caucus last year. So this was the first official meeting of it, I think, was at this convention.
And different caucuses do bring up different issues, like the Veterans Caucus is bringing up the deportation of vets, which is a huge issue, you know. So,
yeah,
it just depends on which caucus, like, and then there's resolutions that can come out of those caucuses,
right,
too.
And that's where, how do we get this, the message out of the caucus is the tough part, to, like, get to pass, to make some sort of sweeping change. I mean, at this convention, we highlighted changes in our platform and endorsements for state delegates. I mean, those were, for state offices, and those were the big things on the agenda for us were endorsements and platform. Some big fights over both of those things. Mm-hmm. But I mean, all the platform is, you know, a statement of our values. And even that, it's like, what weight does that really hold, you know?
Especially when candidates, now we finally, after the last rules meeting in November, are requiring candidates to read the platform.
Yeah, they finally have to read.
But they don't have to support the platform.
Right, and it can take all the money they want from organizations or individuals who stand in stark contrast to the principles of our platform. So I mean, what's the point of even having the platform?
Yeah, the argument being, well, that won't exactly work in our area, so I'm not going to support that part of the platform. So you have the state convention having this platform, but it doesn't trickle down to, you know, the actual candidates.
Right. We just got tuition-free public higher education added this year. Awesome. I mean, that's an amazing plank to have in our platform. It belongs there. California should be and can be leading the way on these issues. Now we've got a Democratic supermajority, right? We've got a Democratic governor, and they're all working against. I mean, Jerry Brown says we're not ready for single payer. That's a bold, shining plank in our platform in the Democratic Party. How can you even say that? You know, and it takes a ton of money from the fossil fuel industry, millions in fracking money.
So when he says that we're not ready, is it because a strong bill hasn't been moved forward?
That's exactly what they're all using as an excuse.
Well, no,
but and it's right. You know, the bill that we're trying to push, SB 562, the healthyca.org, everybody can check it out, read the language there. Right now, it's not in the condition it needs to be in. And we'll admit that first, you know, any advocate for it will be the first to admit that. But the only way that we can add to this bill is to get it stuck. Right now, it's called in suspense. It's tabled or shelved by Anthony Rendon, whose name's right here. Look, this courtesy of assembly, we all covered ours on with these stickers instead, because that guy, he didn't even show his face at convention.
And you're pointing to my delegate...
her credentials.
My
there.
Credentials.
Right. And now, the only way we can advance this bill is to get it out of suspense. And there are folks like, again, our own assembly rep, Jim Wood, who are working against that.
But that is actually one of the areas where people listening right now can put pressure on the political system.
Absolutely.
And get instant results that move an issue forward to either it's actually doing something or dying and ending the discussion. They can actually make a difference there.
Absolutely.
But it needs to go through the process. And we have been having... continuous SB 562 canvasses here in Humboldt County, and there's been marches, there's been pressure. We're doing just about, you know, everything we can do to move it out of the Rules Committee and have the legislature actually consider it and support the amendments that will bring it to fruition or to, you know, a solid bill.
Right. So the best things I think a person that's listening right now could do to help advance single payer would be to get involved with the Healthy California campaign at healthyca.org. And, you know, you can volunteer locally. There's updates on that website there, where to come canvas with us, find out more here, and to get involved with some of these protests. And, of course, to support Kevin Murray, because supporting the candidate that's going to bolster robust conversation about these issues in the primaries of these coming months. The primaries are on June 5th. I mean, they're coming up in a few months here. So, you know, get behind the candidate that's going to represent our values. And that's another way you'll find out more. Kevin Murray is out there canvassing with students here.
Let me reframe it differently from the radio station side, because we have a commitment and a necessity of giving candidates of both sides. Jim Wood should be able to come on and speak. What I am encountering, and it's frustrating me after a year here, is we offer local political figures, elected officials, the opportunity to come on and respond, to come on and discuss, be interviewed with their opponents, and we hear nothing back.
I'd love to debate Jim Wood. If you're listening, let's debate on healthcare here.
I would just love
Thursday
to
night
have
talk show.
Some of those elected officials, Board of Supervisor officials, state assemblymen, state senators, to have them actually respond and come on and talk with our listeners about these issues. These are important issues. Some of them are life and death issues. They affect the economy, the social well-being, the culture, the future of our children, our grandchildren. And we cannot get them to actually just turn and face the electorate. That's deeply frustrating.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the one of our goals, you know, the progressive left groups here in Humboldt, is to hold our electeds accountable. And, you know, we've had some luck with some of our electeds, but with other electeds, they just won't engage, not in a good faith effort.
Okay.
Actually, when we were down at the convention, several of us did meet with Senator McGuire, about some of our frustrations. And he was open, you know, to both listening to us, to trying to fix the problems, and to have ongoing conversations with us, which is very, very important.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So California contains, I think I saw one breakout, basically six distinct socioeconomic political regions. I mean, it's in some ways, to state it a little too simply, it's six states in one, okay? They're each good-sized
state.
It is a big state. It's 40 million people, and it has at least five or six distinct socioeconomic regions that are different politically, they're different economically, they're different as to what drives them. What are the issues on the North Coast that we will probably have to sort out ourselves, because the other five regions of the state may not care about them, or they may not have that issue?
Dam removal, water issues, okay. Is
cannabis
one.
Cannabis industry.
Cannabis, yes.
Okay. What about that? Because, I mean, that is now legal statewide. What's unique to the North Coast?
It's that 40 to 60% of our economy is grounded in...
underground economics.
Yeah, it's a legacy industry.
Yeah.
And with the small growers, the ones that have been here for decades.
Right, and that's the unfortunate aspect. I mean, I don't think the money may still come in some way, but it'll be through fewer hands and moving it towards control, towards a monopoly that put in place, rather than the way that things have been, which have supported a greater number of people with smaller projects, which are in turn less impactful on the land. I mean, some people might be arguing that these new regulations would make things more environmentally stable, but what we're actually seeing through this permitting process here in Humboldt is it's driving more growers further underground because they can't afford the permitting processes. And you got to pay $30,000 just to ask Humboldt, hey, can you please permit me? And chances are they won't. So there's a problem.
Okay. Right. What else?
Fortifying the sanctuary. The push for sanctuary law in this region specifically. I think that is... now, we are officially a sanctuary state, but is it being enforced, and how well is it being enforced? And if our local law enforcement and state and county officials will adhere to the push for sanctuary protection. I think that's really big here and really important.
Okay. Other ones?
The lack of employment opportunities here.
Our poverty rate is extremely high.
Pardon me?
Our poverty rate is extremely
high.
It
is extremely high. And, you know, we lose our young, our youth, because there's no opportunity here, no options, so they move away. So, you know, that's something that I haven't seen addressed effectively by our Board of Supervisors or any of our local, you know, officials at this point.
Homelessness?
Homelessness, opioid addiction. Those are all, you know.
All issues pretty
all
much
issues
being
are,
denied by elected officials in many cases.
If it doesn't affect them directly, it's not a problem, right?
Well,
that's what it feels like sometimes.
I mean, I'm a newcomer, but in the last couple of months, we've had several members of the Board of Supervisors question whether we have a shortage of housing. And I look at it and say, you had a Humboldt County grand jury in 2015 tell you the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. And at the statewide level, there's been a discussion of redlining.
Right.
And there is clearly redlining here in Humboldt County as it relates to renting to people of color.
That is,
no, people of color.
Period. Okay. All right.
Professors, administrators here at the university,
okay,
and others, not just students.
Right.
When you have a name like Lorna Bryant and it's, you can't distinguish my race, sometimes I don't have problems. But if I use my middle name, Ledette, I would have a bigger problem.
Okay.
And that's unfortunate. Just with housing, with property management companies locally, some require that you must be, you experienced this firsthand. You have to be here in person to even be considered for property. That is a problem. There should be some sort of law regulating that. Huh. Fair Housing Act. I forgot about that.
Health care is another big issue here, I think, locally.
Absolutely.
There is not adequate general practitioners,
right,
specialists. You know, Humboldt Pediatrics closed, and that's, what, 10,000 patients that now have to drive down to the Bay Area to get, you know, specialized care for cancer.
Okay.
Right. I have to do that myself. I have to go to UC San Francisco because there are no pulmonologists here. There are no endocrinologists here. Yeah. Diabetes is a big problem in our community, but there are no or very few endocrinologists in the community.
It's crazy. Everybody in our community, most of us have teeth, and I got to drive 3.5 hours to the nearest dentist that accepts Medi-Cal.
Yeah, that's...
So, yeah. Wow. I mean, so we definitely have problems.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to your comment about being a sanctuary city or a sanctuary county and a sanctuary state, but let's keep it local. We have several cities that are sanctuary cities. We're, I think, a sanctuary county officially. Yes?
Yes.
Where are we?
Well, there's a sanctuary ballot initiative coming up.
Is there?
Yes.
Coming up? Okay, that's right. It was, right. Okay. How are we doing at the practical level of making students of color, people of color, feel safe and welcome here? I mean, let's get past doing something declarative like a sanctuary proclamation and get down to the ground of what it's like on the ground every day. How are we doing?
On paper or in reality?
In reality.
When the discussion is the same and it hasn't changed, where students of color are saying, I don't feel safe walking outside of campus. Sometimes I don't feel safe walking on campus. I don't feel safe in my community. That's a problem. If you are protecting undocumented people on paper, but undocumented and documented people within the community don't feel safe, what's the point of protecting protecting them as a sanctuary city if you're just not protecting basic things in around personhood?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen. I don't feel safe.
Well,
there are many times people, I have been because of my skin color and because I was born and raised in Los Angeles, the questions I get, well, did you experience crack houses and did you see drive-by shootings? And I am quick to tell anyone who asks me a question like that, I feel most unsafe here in Humboldt County. When I lived in Eureka, I felt extremely unsafe. And it wasn't, it was because of the methamphetamine addiction. I tell people all the time, crackheads are happy and they're not violent and they only steal from their grandma and their auntie. But with the meth addiction, it's equal opportunity. And I did not, and I still don't feel safe in that climate.
In that area.
No.
And in L.A., you look out the door every morning and there's Ike Turner waiting to pick up your brother. That's another story. And Tina Turner. That's another story.
I never saw Ike. Okay. I mean, I never saw Tina. Okay. Ike would come to my house.
That's
frequently.
Another story. We'll leave that for another time. Okay.
I think there's also a legacy here that's still alive and not well of discrimination against Native Americans.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I think we shouldn't forget that.
We saw that last week. With the removal of the McKinley statue, inciting that this is history, I didn't know I could learn from a statue that is inanimate and doesn't tell me a story, but it's historical and it's meaningful, so it needs to remain. And you have the biggest bullhorns, people who don't even live in the community anymore, and McKinley isn't shining down on them, but we at land here, mm-hmm. and the pain associated with McKinley and Indian troubles on a plaque mm-hmm. is so prevalent, but you have people who say the good old days before the others came to our community, which is ludicrous. So why do we need to move it? It may not be painful to you, who is nostalgic every time you think about it, but it's painful to others when there's a direct correlation of violence and hatred and murder and racism associated with that man who's in our town center.
Okay. Final couple of questions here. You saw at least three or four candidates who viable names for presidential run in 2020. Impressions, Robert?
Well, I like Merkley.
Do you?
Jeff Merkley. I would like Merkley more than Kamala Harris. And I think that would just be because I follow the money and I look at the people's candidates' use of their political capital and their expenditure of that dirty money that they're getting, if any. And so I don't like the picture that paints for Kamala. And I dig Merkley, and I like that he cast his superdelegate vote for Bernie.
A couple of other names that show up frequently, Eric Garcetti, mayor of Los Angeles.
No, not a fan at all.
Billionaire Tom Steyer.
Garcetti, he doesn't look out for the homeless. He doesn't look out for the people that are struggling in his city. He did nothing for Aliso Canyon, the biggest leak of you know, outside of fracking leak outside of L.A. We protested him at the convention for that, actually. That was fun. Who else? Tom Steyer. He doesn't use his money too wisely either.
Yeah, I would agree. Merkley would be the only person that I could, you know, feel good about. I'm actually hoping that other people jump in to the race.
Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, am excited to see how the race progresses as we get closer to 2020. Mm-hmm. But I'm keeping my eye on Sister Kamala.
Okay, any final takeaways? Any final thoughts?
Mine is that everybody listening, if you could take the time to listen to us talk about politics for an hour, that you should be getting yourself involved to a greater degree than whatever it is that you're involved. We need everybody's passion and energy and interest in the issues we've been talking about here to make any of this come to fruition. You know, otherwise, we're just sweating and crying away for nothing. We need everybody involved.
Are you convinced, Robert, that California can help lead the way?
Of course California can lead the way. I think we all know that. Okay. And we're really on with single payer, we're on the precipice. I mean, the establishment is hurting. We are a force to be reckoned with. The nurses union, with all of these progressive, the word progressive's losing some meaning, but with all of our progressive super force pushing, my goodness. Okay. Now we just need everybody else that's listening. Get involved. Do it now.
Okay.
HealthyCA.org.
I think it's well recognized that California is at the forefront. As California goes, it will really push the DNC to go that direction. There is a unity commission that came out of the DNC that's going to be voted on soon.
Okay.
And we're really pushing, you know, for that to be adopted by the DNC. California is, you know, one of the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. And
sixth largest, yes.
Yeah. So,
for me, before our current administration, I had no interest in politics. I have an extreme interest now, both at the national, state, and in fact, local level. It's nice to see the interest in civic engagement that has come out of our current presidential administration. You're seeing more women becoming civically engaged, more women running for office, more African Americans running for office, and I'm excited to see where that goes. During the convention, Shirley Chisholm, who I met here at Humboldt State in 1987, I believe, she had a quote. They mentioned a quote that means so much. That's right. That
Robert has the button.
Yes. I have one of her original presidential election buttons somewhere. Hers and Jesse Jackson's, but I digress. But she was quoted, "If they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair." And that alone, between that and Auntie Maxine's party at the end of the convention, it inspired me.
And you went to bed before her, and she's 79.
I know. Maxine Waters can party. She had the best party of the whole convention.
Let's play off what Robert said and what all of you have actually said. California is a leader in politics. It's a leader in the resistance of politics at this moment in history. And Humboldt County has a role to play in that. We may be isolated, we may be rural, but we have some key players here. Mm-hmm. And if people will engage, we can have an impact.
That's right. We do have an impact.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it very much. I'm going to hand it back to you, to Michael. Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Thanks, Peter. You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thank you to our host, Peter Fretwell, and to our guests, Helene Rouvier, Bobby Shearer, and Lorna Bryant. We'd love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Eric Kirk will be hosting next week's Thursday Night Talk. Thanks to our producer, Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next.